A prodigal of God. Imagine a story about a recklessly extravagant man who has lost two sons to two different shades of pride. To each he goes out, forgives, welcomes, offers his wealth, and invites them in to a party because he is happy. Imagine his joy withstanding their selfishness. Two sons who only speak of what they want from him, who distance themselves from him and each other, and still his joy overflows. Imagine a God so prodigal with grace and blessing, who loves us who have strayed, and us who think we're more deserving, and free of our past, embraces us all and is happy. Imagine being a prodigal of God, extravagantly loving, spreading it wantonly, forgiving the undeserving, living in the present moment, totally free, trusting God's abundance, and full of joy. Amen. So what sorts of images come to mind, your mind, when you hear the term manly man? Manly man. How would you identify a manly man? What would he look like? How would he behave? How would these characteristics carry over into his fathering? How would you describe a manly father? The dictionary describes a manly man as having qualities traditionally ascribed to men, such as strength or bravery. Related words include noble, vigorous, bold, masculine, virile, macho, self-reliant, heroic, audacious, brave, confident, daring, dauntless, dignified, fearless, firm, and gallant. I don't know about you, but that list sounds exhausting to me and not very realistic. Nor do men have any exclusive claim on any of these qualities. I know many men over time have tried to live up to some or all of this definition, but at great cost to themselves and to the people in their lives. In many ways, this notion of manliness is outdated. The myth of manliness is increasingly being abandoned, although not necessarily in the centers of power these days, but increasingly being abandoned as we also learn to let go of patriarchy and male domination with their often attendant misogyny, violence, and abuse. Well, by now you may be wondering what all this has to do with the parable of the prodigal son. Well, one of the lectionary resources I look at, Seasons of the Spirit, suggests this week's theme be a traitor for grace. A traitor for grace. When I first read those words, I was surprised and wondered myself what this might have to do with the familiar parable from the Gospel of Luke. We know about the rebellious younger son and the recalcitrant older brother. We know of the waiting father whose response to both his boys is characterized by love and grace. So who is the traitor in this tale, and who or what is betrayed? The season's background reflection observes that traditionally the emphasis of this story is on human sinfulness as reflected in the wasteful son, the upright, self-righteous older brother, and the gracious father who forgives all. They write, the focus is on our individual solitary brokenness. That's the approach which is familiar to us. But the writers continue, if one reads the story through the lens of Jesus' liberating Jubilee mission set forth by Luke in the fourth chapter, the story becomes about the failings of the two sons, becomes less about the failings of the two sons, and instead a story about a patriarch who rejects patriarchal rules. The father in the story is a traitor to the norms of patriarchy and empire, which function in a linear world of control and consequences. Well, that's an approach to the text that never crossed my mind before. This is a tale of a traitor for grace, or if you will, a parable of an unmanly father. Bill Herzog's Parables as Subversive Speech, Jesus as Pedagogue of the Oppressed, asks us to consider the parable as social and cultural commentary as much as it is about individual sin and personal salvation. Let's look more closely at how this may be so. To begin with, we know that this is a family of some wealth. In Jesus' cultural context, those listening would have immediately identified the father as a patriarch. He would not only have possessed land and fathered sons, he also would have been respected in his village as a man of means and influence. In this society, so shaped by honor and shame, he would have secured his place of prominence in the circle of men, the elders, who would gather in the village square or at the city gate to discuss the sacred scriptures, dispense their wisdom, and exercise their authority. In this setting, the father would have been at the top of the social ladder. He would have much to lose by failing to meet the expectations of a patriarch in his community. To put this a little more in context, this chapter of Luke begins with Jesus in conversation with a group that included his followers and his adversaries. The mixture was uncomfortable for the religious authorities, who were focused on sustaining their purity codes that stated very clearly who should be included and who should be excluded. Luke introduces the lesson this way. By this time, a lot of men and women of doubtful reputation were hanging around Jesus, listening intently. The authorities and religious scholars were not pleased. Not pleased at all. They growl. He takes in sinners and eats meals with them, treating them like old friends. What's wrong with him? What could be worse in their well-ordered world than hanging out with the wrong sort of people, except for actually enjoying table fellowship with the wrong kind of people? Luke continues, their grumbling triggered this story. This story about the unmanly father who also violates their rules and expectations. Scene one. The man's younger son comes to his father and demands his inheritance. Father, I want right now what's coming to me. This is unheard of. Imagine the gall of this young man making demands on his father, let alone asking for his share of the family fortune. Richard Vinson writes, our best guess is that Jesus is spinning a situation that none of his audience had ever heard of, and that they would have been shocked at the young man's callous disregard for his father's feelings, to say nothing of his father's honor and the family's position in the village. Vincent quotes another New Testament scholar, Kenneth Bailey, who claims, any Middle Eastern son who requests his inheritance from a healthy father is understood to want his father to die. Such a son is dead to the family. It's just as well that the younger son takes off for a distant country, because he certainly would have been persona non grata in his home and in his village. In scene two, to no one's surprise, the younger man's son, undisciplined and dissipated, has wasted everything he had. Of course, then, there's a famine in the land, and he's destitute and starving, reduced to slopping pigs and the prospect of gnawing on a leftover corn cob, all of which brings him to his senses. My favorite line from the story, he brings him to his senses. He reasons, all those farmhands working for my father sit down to three meals a day, and here I am starving to death. So he hatches a plot. I'm going back to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you. I don't deserve to be called your son. Take me on as a hired hand. And he got right up and went home to his father. Now you can imagine the reaction of Jesus' listeners. Oh, sure, his father's going to take him back as a hired hand. Fat chance. He's dishonored his dad, and he's cut the family ties. He's disgraced himself and brought shame on the whole village. There's no place for him on the farm or in the community. He might just as well stay where he is. No self-respecting patriarch would welcome him home on any terms, nor would his family or his hometown. Scene three is the father's actual response, to which we'll return in a minute. Scene four, the elder brother behaves just as everyone expects him to. He's been a good boy and a model citizen. He has behaved as a proper patriarch in waiting. He has stayed home, kept his head down, respected his family and his community. He's never even thrown a party for his friends. He has no use for his wastrel brother, and he makes that clear. However, in his diatribe against his brother and his refusal to join the party, he disrespects his father every bit as much as his younger brother. In the end, he is no more an obedient son than his brother was. His bitterness gets the better of him, and he too trods on his father's feelings. Vincent suggests that this exchange is not a private one. Given the typical construction of houses and layout of villages, it's likely that it went on close enough for those gathered for the party to see and hear what was going on. He writes, even if we think of a more modest house, the father meets his older son in the street, just as he met his younger son in the road outside of town. This meeting, like the one just earlier in the day, is public. Vincent continues, the elder son is, if anything, ruder than his brother. He will not, for the sake of appearances, go in and make small talk and then have this out later behind closed doors. So back to patriarchy and power. It's well within the right of this father to disown both of his boys for their insubordination and their lack of respect. Instead, we find a father so steeped in love and compassion, He's willing to leave his patriarchal rights and privileges behind and behave like a fool for his family. He's willing to risk the shame to give grace. There are things that mean infinitely more to him than his standing in the community, than his patriarchal power, than his appearance of manliness. The season's lectionary resource points out that the father makes no claims of authority on his younger son when his younger son asks for his inheritance. The son is free to live his own life and make his own mistakes. Similarly, there are no demands made on the elder son to live in conformity with the father's wishes. The eldest son is invited and encouraged to join the coming home party, but he remains his own person with the freedom to reconcile with his brother only when and if he is ready to do so. Not only does the father offer great latitude to his sons to make their own choices and live their own lives, he is also very willing to be public about his undying love for his boys. All the while he is sitting with the elders at that village gate, he's taken a place in the circle so he can see the road just in case his wandering son comes home. There is no way this traitor for grace, this unmanly father, will turn his back on his own child. Let the neighbors gossip as they will, he's going to be there to greet his son if and when he returns. And his love and joy at seeing his younger son dragging himself up the road is to run in a most undignified and absurdly non-patriarchal fashion to greet the boy and kiss him and to escort him personally through the village to spare him the expected outrage from the villagers at the audacity of his coming back to them at all. And the unmanly father is just as tender with his elder son when he acts out his anger at his brother's return. The father stands there in the middle of the road and lovingly encourages his older son to come celebrate with him his brother's return. He genuinely wants his elder son to share his sheer joy at the younger son's homecoming. Can't you hear the father's undignified and unmanly joy? Son, you don't understand. You're with me all the time, and everything that is mine is yours. But this is a wonderful time, and we had to celebrate. This brother of yours was dead, and he's alive. He was lost, and he's found. Season says joy is, Jesus is trying to teach the crowd, disciples, men and women of doubtful reputation, and the religious authorities alike, to teach them that patriarchy and empire depend upon, indeed demand, adherence to the rules of conformity and the consequences imposed on those who break those rules. Neither the religious leaders who were unhappy with Jesus welcoming sinners, nor those benefiting from empire domination would be happy with this story of a father who, through his grace and compassion, is a traitor for their cause. For Jesus, the Jubilee rules of grace and compassion are the basis for living in the realm of God and the source of life and celebration. Well, there it is in a nutshell. The parable of the unmanly father, the traitor for grace, the unlikely Christ, the holy one for whom grace and compassion are the basis for living in the realm of God and the source of life and celebration. May it be so for us as well. And in its reality, may we find not only our personal redemption, but a story that has the power to turn the world right side up. Amen.